coming to you live from 12,000 years in the future. I'm the unfrozen head of Johannes Stauffer, and with me as always is the partially defrosted left patella of Mikhail Gorbachev. And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 27. Yes, Isaac, we know these episode numbers don't match up.
Welcome back, podcast fans. My name's Tom.
And I'm Johannes Stauffer.
Yeah, am I supposed to be using my last name here?
Well, I mean, I do.
Oh, okay.
Do you have a last name?
Nope. I'm like a prince in that way.
Yeah? We'll make one up for you then.
What is it?
Wiener Hands.
Okay. My name's Tom Wiener Hands. I'm Tom Rich.
And I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. We are glad to have you back because tonight is a very special episode of the Mildly Alarming Podcast. We are going to ask you to contribute to the gloriousness of our podcast.
Oh, yes.
Because we have been called out.
In a way.
We have been called out, not even in a way, it is direct, it is slanderous, and I, for one, will not stand for it. I will not stand for it, sir.
You are sitting now.
Well, but you don't stand when you podcast, dude.
I don't know, maybe someone does.
But at any rate.
In fact, the one who called us out did.
He did he?
Well, I don't know if he does anymore. He used to have a video with his podcast, and he definitely stood through the whole thing.
He is a monster. We're talking about...
He will not sit for this.
We are talking about the host of the 5-Minute Geek Show, a podcast so nefarious, so villainous, so filled with iniquity that it cannot be described.
Yeah, something like that.
Yes. In the latest 5-Minute Geek, which is probably short for 5-Minute Greek, and he just cut the R out because that's the kind of villain that this man is.
That is nefarious.
He said, quote, and I quote, let me go to my notes so that I may quote, that some podcasts state that you want to do podcasts as if our moms were listening.
And now, to be fair, we said podcast like your parents are dead, so... He could be calling out someone else.
Precisely. But clearly he was not.
Okay.
And so with this slight upon our integrity, for that was his topic, was integrity.
True.
In podcasting and in life generally. And his implication is clearly that the Mildly Alarming Podcast is not the pinnacle of artistic integrity and literary genius. And so we declare podcast war on the 5-Minute Geek Show.
Podcast war. Get your podcast swords and your podcast spears. Mount up on your podcast horses. Don your podcast armor. Or at least, you know, get your podcast page to help you put it on.
So gather, come to the weapon take at the Hall of the Podcast Kings.
Which is us, yeah. Presumably.
In this scenario, yeah. And we will ride... to smite the nefarious 5-Minute Geek Show for its slander against our land?
Or podcast.
Our podcast?
So slanderous.
So prepare yourself, 5-Minute Geek Show. We're coming for you.
So now that we're done with that nonsense, what are we actually talking about?
Education and games, or edu games. Edutainment? Edutopia? Actually, that's George Lucas's educational foundation.
Is it really?
Edutopia. Or at least it's something his foundation's involved with.
Huh.
Something I heard it on the radio.
That's dumb.
Yeah, well, you know. What you gonna do?
What you gonna do when they... I'm not gonna finish that. Let's just move on. No. Oh. We're done with this.
We're moving along. Okay. So yeah, we're gonna talk about education in games, how games can be used in educational settings, what games teach... what we've learned from games, and what we've learned from our friendship over the years.
Friendship.
It's really the greatest treasure.
How is the integrity of our friendship?
Is it like a boat? Or
well, it's a friendship, right?
Listen, I'm not going to lie. We've been talking about the 5-Minute Geeks episode on integrity for a while this afternoon. You're probably going to want to listen to it. I don't think we're going to avoid making reference to boats and how their hulls have integrity.
They do indeed.
But anyway, we have a couple of articles that we read about education in games because we do a lot of research on the Mildly Alarming podcast.
This may be the first time we've prepared for an episode, except for the first episode where we based the entire first half of it on someone else's content. Thanks, Cracked.com.
Cracked.com is not a sponsor yet, still, but we're working on it.
Yeah, not very hard, though.
I called them.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't believe you even for a second.
I picked up the phone and I put in the number.
It was the number, like, if you typed the word cracked on a phone pad,
No, I'm not an idiot.
I would contest that.
All right, so educational video games, board games, all that good stuff. You know, I think one of the things that struck me was the brick you threw at me with your thoughts on the matter wrapped around it. But once I had regained consciousness and had read that note, the other thing that struck me in a more metaphorical sense was the quote from the Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe that he wrote down on it. He is quoted as saying, "I am on record as saying that all games are educational. It's simply a matter of what they teach. Minecraft is a game, and this game has rules. You can give those rules more or less weight, but it is also a one-to-one model of people and interactions." Or just regular actions, not interactions, sorry. Which means that, among other things, they can learn about being human. So, obviously, you know, he's an astronomer, so he knows quite a bit. But I think that's a good... He raises a good point. All games are educational. It's simply a matter of what they teach. I would further argue that all is educational. It's just a matter of what it teaches. People are always learning from the things around them.
You're just taking us way out of board game territory
now.
Yeah,
we'll swing back. Don't worry. It's like when you slingshot around a star in Star Trek and you go back in time and you fight the Borg.
Sure.
But no, it's true. You can be learning from a game even while you're having fun. And you're gonna pick up stuff. Even if it's just additional practice at a thing you already know how to do, like basic arithmetic or reading words in a language that you speak.
Mm-hmm.
That's education. Part of education is practice of the skills on which you are being educated, so mm-hmm. That's there. It's part of it, but there's other stuff going on.
Well, to take a step back, because you're kind of getting ahead of where I wanted to start with this, the reason the educational games topic came up in the first place was I work for a textbook company. We're always we sell to schools. We're not an evil college textbook company who steals all your money and then buys the books back for a 100th of what they cost you in the first place. We sell directly to schools, and we're always looking for other educational things that we can provide. I was thinking about educational board games, and the ones that we played as kids in class were terrible. They were just so bad. They were like, the concept is you need to learn multiplication tables. And so we've taken multiplication tables and like put them on flashcards and called it a game because there's pictures of animals on them or something. Like, they were terrible. They weren't games at all, let alone good games. And we had a game that we've mentioned before that we jokingly called Math Wizards because it really didn't work out mechanically as a fun game. But part of the problem was that you spent so much time adding and subtracting and dividing numbers that you rolled on hundreds of tiny D6s. And I had this brief thought in my mind that maybe we should just not fix it and release it as an educational game because there's already a lot of math in there, so that's worth something, right? And then I thought to myself, like, that sucks. You shouldn't make a bad game and just release it as an educational game because it's bad. So I got thinking about, like, are there good educational games, and is the distinction between educational games and games even a distinction worth making? So that's kind of what led into this. And that, so that quote from Tycho, who was in fact Tycho from Penny Arcade and not Tycho the astronomer?
Astronomer. Yeah, Tycho Brahe was an astronomer.
Right. He's also still alive and writing a webcomic.
Somebody cut his nose off. He got a silver one.
Right. Yeah, I know that part.
Yeah.
So at any rate,
real weird.
Not the one with the game quote.
He also hung out with a guy named Johannes Kepler, so that's probably the same guy as you, right?
Also, no. No, that joke wasn't funny in, like, third or fourth grade when we learned about Johannes Kepler the first time.
Just like how educational games weren't fun in that, third it or is fourth ex- grade.
In exactly the same way. So anyway, I wanted to kind of explore educational games, and it seems like a topic that was worth actually looking into, which is why we have articles to reference this time rather than just BSing off the top of our heads.
And actually, really, you just paraphrased the title of one of them, the Engadget article you sent entitled "Newell Sees No Distinction Between Games and Educational Games," which is more or less kind of what you were getting at there. Is it worth having a distinction? And Gabe Newell of Valva Software,
right,
doesn't think there is.
Yeah, he gave a pretty good talk. It was right after Portal 2 came out. So again, we're drifting into video games instead of board games because that's what the media out there covers and cares about. Good luck finding articles about board games when you're trying to research topics. There's a lot of crossover. And he said sort of the same thing. There seems to be this distinction between games that are educational and games that are going to be commercially successful, and I'm not really sure I buy into that. We can do this. We can make educational, commercially successful games, which are going to help us both on the game side and on the educational side. I just don't believe in this distinction between games and educational games. A lot of times the label educational games is a way of being an excuse for bad game design and poor production values. And so he's got that same idea that, like, If you're making a game, there's learning involved in it, mm-hmm. just in learning to play the game. And there are things of value to be found in that, even if the game is about, dragons fighting trolls or whatever. Mm-hmm. That game sounds awesome. Let's make that game.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Dragons versus Trolls. We can just call it Dragons versus Trolls. It'll fly off the shelves.
It's a good title. And you've got a built-in kind of mechanic there because trolls... traditionally, they regenerate unless you burn them.
Right.
And dragons breathe fire. So I guess you have a built-in advantage for the dragons.
Yeah, that doesn't seem very fair.
Okay, that didn't quite work. But we can work it. We got to give something to the trolls. Like, maybe there's only one dragon and a bunch of... Okay.
Well, they have that wacky colored hair that sticks up and like a jewel in their belly button, right? How many people who listen to this are old enough to actually understand that reference?
I don't know, but if you are listening to this, I could really use a co-host who, Just help me out here, please.
If you got the trolls reference without Googling it, please let us know, because I'm actually interested. Actually, if you didn't get the trolls reference and you're like, what the hell are they talking about? Let us know and then Google it.
I had to write down trolls versus dragons.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, he's right. The distinction between educational games and regular games isn't really there. And another thing that he pointed out that struck me, and I'm not finding it, quickly scrolling through the article, but I vaguely remember what he said, and I hope I get it right, is he pointed out that when you're making a video game, you have to think about what the player knows how to do at each stage of the game. So, like, when you first plug it in and get going, you don't really know the controls, you're still learning them, so you always get those tutorial levels, and the first mm-hmm. level is relatively simple, and gradually they teach you more powers and moves and abilities and button combos until mm-hmm. finally... by the end of it, you can see the matrix and do the thing, and it's really cool.
I've got a part of the quote here.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Games are becoming increasingly useful as educational tools. From our perspective, it's one of the things we always think about. We always think about games as a learning experience. You can't design a game without thinking about the progression of experiences and skills that a person is going to have. And he goes on to talk about, are they a child or are they a programmer? Where are they coming from? So it's a... basically at Valve now they approach all games as educational experiences. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily seeking to create what we would think of as an educational game like Math Blaster. Mm-hmm. But they're making educational experiences. Actually, there was a video in that, I don't know if the video was linked in the article, but they referenced it. There was a video shown at the thing where he was talking of a 2-year-old playing Portal 2 and like figuring not obviously not playing the game as intended, but mm-hmm. learning about how a computer mouse works and how it actually makes you look around and how the arrow keys or the WASD keys move your character around. This 2-year-old was learning how to interact with a first person computer game.
That reminds me of a story, but I want to come back to that quote, so don't forget.
Yeah, go for it.
Actually, my mother called me recently. And my sister has a kid, he's about a year and a half old now. Mm-hmm. And we'd all been seeing on our, you know, family cell phone plan that our data was all being used up. And some digging was done. And my mom called to tell me that what they discovered was that when my sister's husband was in the truck driving with the kid, he would hand young Henry his cell phone. And, you know, he would put on like some app or whatever for Henry to play with. Henry had figured out how to close the app, go to YouTube, and stream Thomas the Tank Engine videos.
That's
or whatever.
Pretty impressive.
And you know what? I don't have the full story because I haven't talked to my sister yet, but I don't. Obviously, he's not typing Thomas the Tank Engine in the search field, but it's probably appearing in the recent on the side there, and he can hit it, and he knows that will make Thomas the Tank Engine appear. And that was what was using up all of the family's data.
That's amazing. Can the kid even talk yet?
He can kind of burble at you. He knows how to say no. But what I was getting at with that quote, and I'm glad you found it, is that what Gabe is describing, Mr. Newell is describing there in his quote, really echoes a lot of what I was told when I was in grad school and I was taking a class on how to teach because I was a TA. And they were telling us, you know, here's some education theory, here's how to put together your class, and a lot of what he's saying about gradually introducing concepts and releasing responsibility to the player and this, that, and the other echoes the kinds of models that we were encouraged to use in designing our own instruction that we think about when teaching in like a for real grown-up classroom where people pay you to teach them things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see that echoed there, and it kind of reinforces the idea that it's all education, it's all learning. It's just what are you learning are you teaching effectively? And what are you teaching?
Yeah, and if you think about how we as board game designers have to go about creating and ordering rule books and like first play descriptions and like teaching players the game so that they can interact with it on a level that's interesting. We've talked about this before. We talked about it with accessibility last week, and we talked about it when we brought up rule books and probably a few other times, is you are just teaching. You're teaching the players how to play the game, and so they are learning something. And whether you're teaching them how to, you know, add and subtract numbers because they're children and you're making a quote educational game, or you're just teaching them how to interact with your game specifically, there's a thing being taught there. And first of all, it probably is valuable outside of your game, whether or not it has direct real world application. And second of all, learning in any way is valuable. Mm-hmm. It is creating new neural pathways, and it is keeping your mind agile and able to learn new things and do new things.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. So that's cool. And
stay in school.
Or don't, because it's dumb. Tom and I had very different experiences of school in some ways. And identical experiences of school in others.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, that told nobody anything. That was a completely useless statement.
Yeah, and you were saying a moment ago that, about how it won't necessarily be directly applicable to your real life, whatever you're learning coming out of the game. But much of learning isn't directly applicable anyway. You learn how to do all sorts of things that you don't directly one-to-one translate into a new concept.
Right.
Part of one of the difficult things about teaching, and part of one of the important things about learning, is being able to translate a skill or a topic or a concept from one context into another. When a student breaks through and is able to do that, that's a big win. And if you as a person can do that, good job.
Right.
Yeah, so like one of the things I often think about when we're talking about educational games and what people learn from games is how much stuff from running Dungeons & Dragons campaigns in high school was directly applicable for planning and running a classroom when I started teaching.
Mm-hmm.
There was tons of stuff. The thinking about the amount of time you had, the fielding of questions, the letting people go off course while still sticking to an overall course of the given day's conversation to get to where you needed to go.
Right.
Tons of stuff, you know. And so it wasn't identical, but the skills and stuff translated. It was pretty cool.
And so in the interest of full disclosure, we've actually done attempted an educational games episode once before, and it was a disaster. And you'll never hear it ever.
Look for the Mildly Alarming Podcast Lost Episode Kickstarter this fall.
If we hit $1 million, we'll show you our our foibles and failures on mic.
If you give us enough money to retire, we will put that out there for the public, because we will never work again if it's shown.
Exactly. So, but yeah, we talked about how you learned a lot of things in the StarCraft map editor, mm-hmm. and my brothers both learned a lot about writing software from the Duke Nukem 3D map editor,
right,
where you basically had to learn a scripting language just to make things function. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of things. And then Dungeons & Dragons is a great point, too. Like, I think with the dynamic between the two of us, we always sort of go about things assuming that I'm a little more outgoing, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact you're much more comfortable in front of a large group of people than I am, and you, because of Dungeons and Dragons and DMing and running a campaign, and not just running a campaign but doing voices and role playing and all that kind of stuff through mm-hmm. those games that made them incredible for those of us playing, and that's stuff that I'm still not comfortable doing in front of two people, let alone a classroom. So there's a lot of application, and you think of those kids who play Dungeons and Dragons as the introvert, nerds in their mm-hmm. parents' basement, but really they're probably gaining a lot of skills in that, outgoing, interact with a group of people kind of way that your typical jock, whatever other kind of person mm-hmm. might not have.
Depending on how... Yeah, but then at the same time, the jock might be getting it from practices and clowning around with his buddies. The question is always, I think... You can develop these skills in a ton of contexts. It's can you right. translate them to those other contexts too?
Yeah, that's true. So as we were researching, which is again not something we usually do. So
I think research is a strong word for skimming a couple of articles.
I researched them. I read them all several times, except for the one that I just didn't read at all because I didn't get to it. And I have notes and everything right here in front of me, because I knew I wouldn't be able to find the things I wanted in the article if I didn't copy them out and highlight and bold them. But I found another article on Science Daily. We'll link all these articles in the show notes.
Or Schnotes.
Schnotes for short. Right. Educational video games can boost motivation to learn. So again, it's talking about video games, but I actually just thought this was really interesting. This was kind of a little bit off the path of what I was looking for, but it was intriguing to me. They did this study with kids trying to find out if certain games... So I think they specifically used a computer game called Factor Reactor, which is a math game that I've never heard of before. But it allows for individual play, competitive play, and cooperative play. And so they wanted to find out in what ways playing this game helped students both learn but also gain a mindset that was conducive mm-hmm. to learning. And so they made this distinction between two mindsets: mastery of a subject versus performance. Mastery being, say the subject is math, I'm trying to get really good at this because I'm trying to master the concepts, versus performance. And I had some really bad teachers in some classes, and so this really resonated with me. Performance being go do a problem on the board or whatever. Mm-hmm. So now you're in front of the whole class, and it's about being smart enough to do that, and maybe even, showing your classmates how smart you are that you could do it. You're performing. You're not just trying to master the subject and owning your mistakes and trying to learn from them.
So it's a distinction between thinking about it as comparative between you and the other people versus doing it for its own sake, kind
exactly.
of?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly, yeah. Okay. And so they found some stuff that was very, very interesting. Some of it's seems obvious to those of us that play games. Well-designed games can motivate students to learn less popular subjects. Educational games may be able to circumvent major problems plaguing classrooms by placing students in a frame of mind that is conducive to learning rather than worrying about how smart they look. That's that mastery versus mm-hmm. Performance mindset. But the thing that really surprised me was the difference between doing something by yourself, even playing a game by yourself, and playing with other people. And I came to this looking at, they start out saying, we're comparing collaborative play, competitive play, and individual play. And I'm thinking they're going to come out saying, competitive play is bad, individual play is okay, cooperative play is good. And they came down in a totally different way than I expected. So here's a quote from one of the researchers. Or actually, you know, here's just info from the article. In order to test the impact of different settings on learning, students were randomly assigned to play a math game called Factor Reactor, alone, competitively against another student, or collaboratively with another student. The researchers controlled for students' abilities beforehand by conducting a pretest. The findings revealed that students who played the math game either competitively or collaboratively reported the strongest mastery goal orientations, which indicates that students adopted an optimal mindset for learning while playing the video game with others. Their results also showed that students playing under competitive situations performed best in the game. In addition, those playing in both competitive and collaborative conditions experienced the greatest interest and enjoyment. So not only were collaborative and competitive better than individual, competitive was actually the most effective for mastery. So even when competing with one another, they weren't in that performance mindset. And we're getting a little off topic of just educational games in general here, but I just thought that was really interesting, and I wonder how far they didn't explore really outside of the study, because it's a scientific article and that's not what they do, but how much is just being in a competitive or collaborative environment engaging with something, whether or not it's Factor Reactor specifically trying to teach you things about math, how much is just collaboratively gaming, working together or working against, like mind against mind, helpful in any given game?
Yeah, I was really surprised by that. I figured you would, when you got into a competitive situation, definitely you would see performance based rising up to the top because you want to beat the other guy. So I was very confused by why that would be, and I would like to know more.
Would you like to know more?
I literally just said that.
Yeah, okay, sorry. I thought maybe I could make a Starship Troopers reference.
I don't understand that reference.
You shot me down like a big dumb jerk. So I guess now the question isn't so much, are educational games a worthwhile endeavor? It's how do we get games of any sort into learning situations?
I don't know. It's kind of a weird question almost to ask, because a lot of the games that we learned from depend on things you already learned, like reading and math, to a large degree. And so it's hard to translate them down to learn those skills without making the kind of terrible, boring games you were talking about.
That's a good point.
I would have to see Factor Reactor to find out if it's that kind of game or how it looks.
Sure.
And it's probably not much fun for me being a grown man.
Right.
I would assume. But, you know, but if you're trying to design a game that hits those relatively baseline low level skills, I don't know. There just doesn't seem to be much meat on them bones, as it were. And if you're up a few levels on the chain, starts to get so abstract and distanced from things that I don't know that it's worthwhile trying to design a game specifically for that, as opposed to just designing a really good game and letting the concepts and ideas emerge organically from that.
Well, I think, so I was talking to my sister a couple days ago. She's reading a book called the, I want to say it's Breaking Point, and I don't think that's right. But anyway, we were talking about children's television programming and how Sesame Street discovered what they call the James Earl Jones effect. They had a segment of him just saying the alphabet, and they ended up reusing it multiple times. They were going to do something else with it. They were going to put, you know, animations or something over it and change it up. And they ended up just having, it was just James Earl Jones dramatically saying the alphabet. And what they discovered was that the first time a young child watched it, they just listened to it. I'm going to get some of these comparisons wrong, but the progression is similar. The second time, they would repeat the letters after him. And the third time, they would say it along with him. And never were they like, this is boring, I've seen this before. They engaged with it and were interested by it in a different way every time. And learned from it because they're tiny children. And so these are new experiences for them. And so something that to an adult, like seeing James Earl Jones read the alphabet, like I would listen to that. I would mm-hmm. find that interesting because he has an incredible voice.
I'd listen to that at least once.
But three times in a row, I would be like, oh my gosh, why is this happening? But a child interacts with it on a different level every time and they continue to learn from it. And so if you're talking about designing a educational game for a kid who is still learning how to read or is still learning the very basics of math,
mm-hmm.
You may create a game that to you or to me is not in the least bit interesting, but as long as they can engage with it, it could be good. So you still want to include those elements of a game that are fun and engaging, but I don't know, depending on the age, for very young learners at any rate, you can probably keep it at a lower level that we might find uninteresting. And so I'm not saying throw your poorly designed garbage games to the younger kids mm-hmm. without making them worthwhile, but keep in mind in designing that the age recommendation on a game is more than about whether or not you say a swear in one of your cards.
Mm-hmm.
It's about ability and level of education and of development. And so you could make a game that is very, like, I imagine Uno is probably very interesting to younger kids. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it really reaches up into, you know, there probably aren't Uno leagues or Uno competitions. I could be wrong. Maybe they're out there, but that's one of those games that I think is very raw mechanically, and you can interact with it and be interested by it up to a point and then mm-hmm. not anymore.
To tangent a little bit, if mm-hmm. I may, from what you were saying, it's always weird and interesting to me to think about how children encounter things for the first time that you wouldn't think about as things that you ever encounter for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, that was the first time that child saw and was aware of a table. Like, he'd never...
Yeah.
There weren't tables before in his yeah. world, and now there's a table. Or, like, when my nephew first met me, his dad doesn't really have much facial hair going mm-hmm. on, and I have a full and luxurious beard. And so, you know, it might not have been, but it was among probably the first times he had encountered
yeah.
hair on a face. And let me tell you, he tugged on it.
Well, going back to even the repetition thing in young children, my nephew is 3, and he still thinks beards are hilarious, mm-hmm. and he still tugs on them if you pick them up. And it's definitely not the first time he's encountered a beard anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And my niece, who's 2 or so, is the same way. Just like, beards are funny. Play with them. Mm-hmm. This is a new experience, even though it's not a new experience anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're probably gleaning something different from it, or they just think it's funny that they're, you know, grabbing my face.
And pulling on it.
Because they also still think it's real funny to pull my glasses off and throw them on the floor. So.
Well, to be fair, that's pretty funny in
yeah,
general.
Yeah, I know. So that's our less funny, more serious, actually somewhat researched take on educational games. If we left anything out or if you have any input, we'd love to know, especially if you're designers who have experience with designing educational games or like deliberately educational games. Or if not, we want to know what you have to say. So hit us up on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
Shoot us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
You can leave a comment on our website at www.mildlyalarming.com. And we're also now on Stitcher and iTunes. You can leave comments there and give us a good rating if you like the show. And if you hate it, don't leave us a bad rating because that would be hurtful.
And finally, you can inscribe your comment on a cannonball and fire it in any direction. We'll find it.
We're very good at finding cannonballs.
And now a word from our sponsors. The Mildly Alarming Podcast is brought to you by Clicky Keyboards. Have you ever wanted to increase your perceived output at work while at the same time driving your coworkers insane? Now you can! With Clicky Keyboards, every single keystroke can be heard within a 9-block radius, making your Reddit rants and vaguely racist YouTube comments sound like frenzied productive work. Clicky Keyboards. Your boss will love you, and your coworkers will pray for death.
Welcome back. Today we're going to try a new segment that we're calling Booze in the News. And as the night wears on, my Adderall wears off, and our blood alcohol content rises, we're going to discuss some stories in current events. So, Tom, what have we got in the news today?
Well, we've got some exciting stuff happening. Rand Paul announced his candidacy for president. We want to talk about that business?
No, no one wants to talk about that. What's the next one?
Hillary Clinton is expected to announce this.
Is there
this
anything
weekend?
Not political or interesting at all?
Michigan has a vote about
taxes?
Raising the sales tax?
Let's talk about taxes. Okay, no. You're doing this all wrong.
Oh.
Here's what we're talking about. Bull semen. In Leroy, Minnesota, police are investigating the theft of about $70,000 worth of bull semen from a farm in southern Minnesota. In Mower County? I don't know. Apparently, a farmer reported Tuesday that a storage canister with vials of bull semen was taken from his unlocked barn. The theft happened sometime between April 1st and April 7th, which says to me he was not keeping a close eye on his bull semen.
Well, now, let's be fair to the farmer. If you are the sort of farmer who has sufficient bulls to produce $70,000 worth of bull semen, you've probably got a fair bit of land.
I guess.
And it's not hard to tuck away a bucket of bull semen somewhere and not check on it for a few days.
It's an expensive bucket.
You might not need it right away.
It's presumably that's why you would store it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It says here that the canister was worth about $500. Just the canister. That's an expensive canister, whether or not it has bull semen in it. Like, you lock that up.
Yeah.
And the vials were worth between $300 and $1,500 apiece.
I have several questions.
No, hold on. The final sentence of the article is my favorite. Police have no suspects.
Yeah, but I mean, you live out in rural Minnesota. You've just finished filling your canister of bull semen with a bunch of vials. In some way, actually, funnily enough, I have read articles about how you collect bull semen,
yeah,
so I know how that business goes down.
I watch Dirty Jobs.
Yeah, so
let's move on.
Moving on.
Let's not get too deep into that.
You got the bull semen. You got the bull semen collected, and you tuck it away in a room in one of your many barns,
as you do,
and you don't worry about it because you're in rural Minnesota. Who's going to come find it?
Well, presumably in rural Minnesota, your competing farmer, you know, down the way, who your family has been feuding with for generations, for who can breed the best bull or cow, mm-hmm. or bull cow hybrid.
Yes, the bull cow hybrid known as a bull or a cow.
a bow? A cull?
Oh my god.
how do cows work anyway?
Well, well, actually, in this case, when a cow and a mechanical inseminator love each other very much.
Mechanical inseminator?
I didn't know the technical term, and I didn't want to say turkey baster.
No, but I think that was actually correct, but also band name.
Absolutely.
So, moving on to things hopefully closer to home and less offensive to...
Hold on.
We're going to keep talking about bull semen.
I have another important question about the bull semen story.
Please.
It says that the vials of bull semen were worth from $300 to $1,500 apiece.
Right.
What the hell is the difference between two vials of bull semen? I guess we don't know if they came from the same bull.
Yeah, we know. Like, one bull only has, like, three legs and he's got an extra horn.
So that's the cheap bull.
No. One horn per leg. It's all about horn to leg ratio.
Because, like, right. I wouldn't think it would be quantity, because you'd fill them up. You could come back the next day or later in the same day and collect some more.
Presumably.
Like the bull's not going to complain, I don't think.
Let's not explore this much further.
But I'm just curious. That's a pretty hefty difference. Like, is it just you happen to have one vial from, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the other vial from...
Woody... Allen bull. I guess that bull could be really good at creating films, so
yeah,
maybe it would be worthwhile too.
Yeah, it would work
too.
But you've got one from like a great bull and one from kind of a cruddy bull. But like, is there a difference? Like, if I've got two vials of of bull semen from my best bull. Are they of the same value?
One would assume.
Or like, do you test...
Listen, I read the article you read. I can't answer your question.
Do you test...
Rephrasing it is not going to help your case.
Do you test the viscosity of the bull semen?
Moving on to something less gross and closer to home. Daily Dot Comcast refused to cancel customer service after his house burned down. This is not a headline that is so much surprising as it is just relatable to everyone who has ever dealt with Comcast in any way. I have spent the last 2 years trying to get Comcast to take my money, to provide me their service at my place of employment. And yesterday was the first time that actually worked. So I'm not really surprised about this. But yeah, his house burned down. Apparently, his daughter called up and was like, hey, cancel this. And they were like, no, you're not the person with the service. And she was like, okay, fine, talk to my dad. And they were like, what's your account number? He's like, I don't know, my house burned down. And they were like, well, then we can't. So you just have to keep paying us forever. Eventually, they worked it out, I guess.
That's probably for the best.
But, you know, maybe... Hey, my house burned down. Can you turn off my internet? Should be like, oh, I'm so sorry that your house burned down. Let me do everything I can for you. Not like, all right, only if you can read me a 14-digit number.
From the charred remnants
from the charred remains of the place where you raised your children.
Ah, good times. My best cable company horror story actually comes from AT&T because I've never had Comcast.
Yeah, they're worse.
Whatever.
In my humble opinion, Comcast and AT&T, if either of you would like to sponsor us, we'd, you know, totally take your money.
Yeah, it'd be fine, but we'd still mock you on the
air. Yeah.
But I was moving and I was transferring my internet over and all that nonsense. And in, I don't remember all the details, but I was talking to their customer service rep on the phone and she said, okay, I'm going to give you a ticket number now. Write this down because when you get your first bill at your new address, they're going to double charge you.
I love that.
It's going to happen, and then give them this ticket number, and that will help you get them to reverse the charge. But they're going to, I'm just telling you like it is, man. They're going to double charge you.
Yep.
And she was very friendly.
Yeah.
But I was like, I guess I appreciate the honesty, but maybe your company should be better, and I know it's not your fault.
Maybe
but
change your policies just a little bit. Just,
maybe do things correctly.
You know, if you can.
If possible, it'd be nice.
But yeah, they actually did that to me, too. They were like, okay, we know you're providing your own modem, but they're going to charge you for a modem. And there's just nothing I can do about that. So just here's the number to call when they charge you for a modem to tell them to not charge you for a modem. And I did that. This was the best. I did that. And they were like, oh, we're so sorry. We'll take that charge right off. But we can't give you any money back. So we're going to credit your account. So don't pay your bill for the next 2 months because that's how much the modem costs. And I was like, sure, this sounds shady. But, you know, the guy at AT&T told me. And I was like, okay, I didn't. And then they sent me like, you know, late. We're going to send it to collections notices for several months until I waited on hold for 6 hours to talk to a person and work it out again. It was a ton of fun. Way to go, AT&T. Really the pinnacle of customer service.
Yeah.
Doing things in the world to make Comcast seem less bad.
Let's say noble goal, I guess.
I guess.
One way or another.
So this is my last headline, unless you've got anything going here. So from the real deal, New York hipsters are being encouraged to move to Detroit. I feel like this is a not all that well obscured attempt to thin the hipster herd.
Sort of like driving them over a cliff or into an ambush.
Yeah. Well, no, but encouraging them to do that themselves because no one else is doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be not yet cool. So if you do it now, you'll have done it first.
Yeah. So the article discusses how in places in New York that I don't recognize because I've never been to New York and I never want to go there. And if you live in New York, I don't care if that hurts your feelings. But they're seeing billboards that say things like Detroit, just west of Bushwick. I don't know what that means.
I don't either.
And Detroit, be left alone, except by the crackhead stealing all of the copper wiring out of your home.
Yeah.
But he's going to bug you. Like, he probably doesn't really care about you all that much. As long as you stay out of his way, he's not going to bite you or anything.
But he's really excited about all that copper wiring.
Yeah. And, you know, I poop on Detroit a little bit because I was raised near Ann Arbor.
That's real gross.
That's what we do. We mock Detroit while fearing it.
Yeah.
And assuming that everything across the Wayne County line is the worst part of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much how... Was that your experience growing up?
Yeah.
Yeah, you cross over Rawsonville Road, and you are immediately in one of those movies that are set in the ghetto.
And you fear for your life.
Yeah, and you're shot. Like, gunfire starts mm-hmm. erupting around you. And then you cross back, and you are back in the Shire from Lord of the Rings. Like, have you ever noticed that living in certain parts of Southeast Michigan is like living in the Shire?
Yeah, kind of.
There's nothing bad ever happens, really. Like, the worst is that sometimes it gets real cold.
Yeah.
And even then, it's like, oh, cold. And it's not like Buffalo, New York, where like, we have 18 feet of snow.
I'm so jealous. Yeah. Not enough to move to Buffalo, New York, mm-hmm. New York, but just yeah. a hair less.
Yeah, but you know, their weather is like legitimately dangerous to life. And Lamar's yeah. like, well, maybe if you're not careful when you drive, you might spin out and go in a circle 360 degrees.
Yeah, so side note there, Michigan drivers, it snows every year.
Every year.
You got to remember that happens, and what you did last time after you spun out and figured out how to drive in the snow and ice. Just every year, don't do the part where you forget once it gets sunny that snow happens,
mm-hmm.
and we'll all be better off.
Yeah, you should remember it.
Just be like, oh, what did we do last time and the time before that? We slowed down and we controlled our motor vehicles in a responsible manner,
mm-hmm.
and none of us died.
Nobody died.
Yeah.
Well, somebody died. Probably,
right, right. But you learn from their mistakes instead of your own.
You know, and to go back to Detroit.
Yeah.
The idea in the article seems to be that Detroit is like a land of it's a land of opportunity in the way that like
there's all that copper.
All that copper, yeah, but in a similar way to like a howling wilderness.
Oh yeah,
would
yeah.
be a land of opportunity that you can go there and
you can carve out a living for yourself.
That's, you know, it's not said in so many words, but that's the impression I get from the article. Things like Detroit is a lot more spread out. There's less people there.
Uh-huh.
You can just buy a house for $11 and live in it.
Isn't that a problem with Detroit? Like, I remember a couple of years ago, they were trying to get people who live in the far-flung reaches of Detroit to move more centrally so they can mm-hmm. just shut off utilities to those abandoned parts of Detroit.
Yeah, and it's a huge problem. Detroit is a city for, you know, several million people that has shrunk
yeah.
enormously over yeah. the last, you know, 50 to 70 years. It's a significant issue. But that's kind of the point the article's making, is that in Detroit there's a lot of empty space that you could go, and you could, if you were a young New York hipster with a trust fund, you could start a business there.
Or you could live in an abandoned home for free.
Or you could live in an abandoned home for free.
I have a friend who did that in Philadelphia, actually.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow the water and other utilities were still on. I don't know why that was the case.
I had a guy who invited me to live with him in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, it made me uncomfortable. I didn't go. For this record... Out there in the internet?
He's still here in this suburb of Detroit.
Are we in a suburb of Detroit?
Well, that's the flip side, right? So everyone in like the Ann Arbor area feels like they're in the Shire. And people in the parts of Detroit that are still... Or like suburbs of Detroit. I don't know. What is Downriver? That's not really Detroit, but it's Detroit, right?
I think Downriver is actually inside the city of...
Is it?
I think so.
So the places in... Or people in still relatively... I don't know if I want to say affluent, but functioning parts of Detroit.
Non-apocalyptic.
Have this idea that Ann Arbor is a suburb of Detroit. And that's fine. Like, maybe that's probably in part how Ann Arbor came to be Ann Arbor. But
mm-hmm.
People from Ann Arbor, because of their we're in the Shire, we're separate and different and better mm-hmm. mentality, do not take well to that.
Well,
and you see this kind of funny butting of heads. Of people who are like, oh yeah, you know, all those suburbs of Detroit, like Ann Arbor, and Ann Arbor people being like, we're from Ann Arbor, ha 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 ha.
Well, you know, and growing up here, I never felt like Ann Arbor was connected to almost anything.
Exactly.
Like we grew up in this. I don't know. Do we want to reveal
this?
Yeah, go for it. We grew up in Dexter, which is definitely a suburb of Ann Arbor, or at least a satellite of Ann
Certainly.
Arbor. And it never felt like Ann Arbor, the Ann Arbor area. If you were connected to Ann Arbor, it felt like that was about it. Like, even just going north, like, Brighton feels like a satellite of somewhere else
yeah.
that you would go to.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it's linked to Ann Arbor. You go to Jackson, it feels like it's linked up to some other portion of the state. Probably Lansing, I would guess,
yeah.
is what my impression of Jackson is. You go over toward Detroit, it feels like it's a different animal mm-hmm. linked to all sorts of stuff. You go north, and you get up toward Flint, it just doesn't feel connected. And, like, you hear about places like University of Michigan, Flint, and U of M Dearborn, you're like, yeah, but those are they have the same name, but they're entirely different schools.
Yeah.
Ann Arbor, just it's extremely disconnected from the things around it.
Yep.
Because it's Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
And if you've met Ann Arbor people and grew up there, you're like, yeah, I get it. I get how that is.
Yep.
It's like how in The Lord of the Rings, the Shire was very disconnected from the lands around it.
Sure.
Like, even though...
Plus, everyone in Ann Arbor is very short and has hairy feet and they don't wear shoes.
Even though the city of Fornost was on the North Downs just past the Shire, it wasn't very far away. The Shire never really, you know, was part of, you know, the Northern Kingdom of Arnor.
Right, nerd.
I know, right?
Well, this has been Booze in the News.
Booze in the News.
You may run into a few other weird little themed segments like this, if you guys like them, or if you don't. We don't care if you don't. We're going to keep doing them because we enjoy them. But if you like them, let us know.
And you're not listening because you're not real.
I haven't even been posting these on the internet. We just look at each other and talk into microphones.
You told me you'd been posting it.
So anyway, if you like these, or if you have other ideas of topics you'd like us to discuss, Booze in the News style or otherwise... let us know on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
Shoot us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Out of your email gun, or hit up the comment section on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com.
Or write it on your face and walk around. We'll find you.
We also have to mention that we're on Stitcher and iTunes, and if you like it, leave a rating. And if you don't like it, leave a good rating anyway out of the goodness of your heart.
Yeah, we're a real charity case.
Yep. See you next week.
Onward.
Americans have always wanted the best from their podcasts. That's why at Mildly Alarming Podcasts, we only make the best, longest-lasting podcasts on the road. A 5-liter V8 engine and an all-steel frame make a podcast that goes the distance. For the rancher, the builder, the farmer. Mildly Alarming Podcasts. Real podcasts for real America.